Hi, my name's Susie. I'm an alcoholic. I like saying that I'm an alcoholic because it tells me what my problem is. I always knew that there was a problem. I always felt like I belonged in a factory outlet store. If you've ever been in a factory outlet store and you pick something up, it has a little tag on it that says factory second, slightly imperfect, defective, something like that. And I felt like that certainly had to be on me somewhere. Because I always felt like there was a problem. And when I finally got into Alcoholics Anonymous and surrendered, I knew that the alcoholism was the problem, which is the good news, but the bad news means that the problem is really me. and that's, you know, a blessing and a curse. I'm really grateful to be here tonight. I've heard Warren was out, and I'm really happy to be able to take his place. I have to start my story at the very beginning because my first drink was before I was born. My biological mother was unable or unwilling to stop using drugs and alcohol during her pregnancy. And I've never met this woman, but I know a little bit about her. And late in her pregnancy, she went to a adoption agency, which was essentially a home for unwed mothers, and decided to put me up for adoption. And she was drunk and using drugs, and she was able to narrow my selection of fathers down to three. And she seemed to be, before I got sober, I called her an alcoholic whore. And it's important to know that because later in my story you'll see how I've grown. And what happened was she went to this agency that allowed her to have a significant say in my placement, in who adopted me. And this woman chose, she had these criteria. She wanted a college-educated couple who were married and the wife didn't work outside of the home, and who regularly attended and were active in a Protestant church. So here's this woman, drunk and on drugs, not knowing who my father was, selecting Ward and June Cleaver to be my parents. And if you're too old or too young to know who Ward and June Cleaver are, just think about the most conservative, traditional, salt of the earth, light of the world, hardworking, God-fearing, pillar of the community people, and that's Bob and Nell, who are the people who adopted me. And I was in an incubator for a month detoxing, and I was in a special needs foster home for a month just to make sure that I was not in any danger. And then the adoption agency, I didn't fit with Bob and Nell. I was the alien from outer space, and like I'd stand outside as a kid waiting for like the mothership to come and take me back to the family where I really belong. And the agency, adopting a child was a very invasive process. And Bob and Nell had to open up their whole lives to this process, to these strangers, their finances, their personal life, their home, their education. And they could do that really easily because they had nothing to hide. I don't understand that. That was never my makeup. I always felt that there was something to hide, even when I was really young and I didn't know why I felt that way. There was always something like, if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me, kind of thing. So I always felt that my life was a closed book rather than an open book. But they were real open, and they went before the judges and blah, blah, blah. And the agency asked them if they were willing to take a child with special needs. And here's an excellent example of my parents, is they have told me that what they did was they prayed about the child that they were adopting. And they trusted God to give them the right child. So they called the adoption agency and they said, sure, we can take a child with special needs, that's fine. But their idea of a child with special needs was some sort of obvious diagnosed thing. You know, they're impaired in their sight or their hearing, or they have a mental challenge or something that you could see that was diagnosed that we can work with. It'll be, you know, fine. And they got me, and God bless them for that willingness that they had. And so they picked me up from the adoption agency, and I screamed for the first 3 years of my life. Every night I screamed loudly, which tells us that I was restless, irritable, and discontented from the very beginning. So my alcoholism was in full swing, and I'm three. So this is going well. And they were very loving and patient, and also very practical, and took me to doctors who would look at my medical records and say, well, she's going to be a little tightly wound, and she's going to grow out of it. And I'm 41, and we're waiting for the growing out of it. Any day now, we're all sure it's going to happen, and it hasn't. But that was it from the start. Something was wrong. Something was wrong with me. And I felt it. And they never gave me any inkling that I wasn't their child. I knew I was adopted, and I got it, but I was always their child, and there was never any sort of... It wasn't their doing. The feeling of not belonging was my doing. I always felt less than, and I was always in fear, and I didn't know what I was in fear of, but I was really afraid, and I would tell you that I didn't like people, but I was really afraid of people. So as a child and as an adolescent, what I would do would be, I would not like you before you even knew my name, and I would behave in a way that you didn't want to know. So I was living in this way where I was just pushing you further and further away out of fear. And I had my first drink on Park Avenue in Winter Park at a bar called Two Flights Up that is no longer there because I don't drink anymore. And and I was 13, and I didn't necessarily like the drinking, but I loved the bar. I loved the dark atmosphere, and you couldn't really see anybody, and they couldn't really see you, and it was just right for my whole I don't want you to know me chameleon life thing that I had going on. And it was also, drinking in the house where I grew up was a ritual. It was an event. So Bob would come home from work and would have one scotch in the right glass that was just lovely with the proper accompaniments. So it was a thing. It was an event. But it was always just one glass. Bob and Nell had a Millennium New Year's Eve party with a full bar, and there's still alcohol from that party in their liquor cabinet today. Whereas I could buy the biggest bottle of vodka you could find, and you could throw the top away because I wasn't going to need it. I was going to drink until that bottle was gone. And that's how I drank. And that's not how they drank. So this was a thing that was in me, regardless of this fabulous environment in which I was raised. So Bob and Nell are doing the absolute best they can with me as their child. And that night that I drank at Two Flights Up, I came home, and I always kept my curfew, because the key to functioning in my house where I grew up was, if you kept your curfew and you had good grades, you were all set. So I was good with that, because I worked well in any situation where I could manipulate things to get what I wanted. And if all I have to do is follow a couple simple rules, I'm all set. So I walk in from my night out at Two Flights Up, and in order to get to my bedroom, you have to walk in front of the television, and my parents are sitting on the couch, and I fall flat on my face, right in front of Bob and Nell, in the living room. It's lovely. And luckily, they grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, when Milwaukee, Wisconsin was still where all the breweries were. So they had, you know, their own little teenage drinking things, and my father worked summers and lived in an apartment over a brewery. So, you know, this was sort of laughed that off. And I didn't pursue the drinking, but I pursued the atmosphere. So when I was 16 and I had to get a job, I got a job at a bar that masqueraded as a restaurant and had nickel beer night. And I wasn't old enough to serve, but I was in the atmosphere. I was home. You know, I was with my people. And I'm still with my people, but we're not drinking today, so that's good. And I'm working, and I'm drinking. And I'm still in high school, and I'm miserable. And I have a thought, which is always the first problem. I have a thought that I need to get out of Orlando, you know? Orlando's all right, but I'm bigger than Orlando, right? I gotta go. and I want to get out of high school quickly. So I take summer school classes and I take these equivalency exams so I can get the hell out and go. And I have a character defect. My primary character defect was, and apparently will be forever, a lack of a filter between my brain and my mouth. So I have thoughts in my head that are completely inappropriate, that nobody needs to know. And before I know what's happening, it's out in the universe. and I'm in trouble. And this kept happening in high school. I was in high school for 3 years at Lake Brantley High School. I was suspended 4 times in 3 years for what is essentially insubordination. Because what would happen is this. I'm sitting in class, and I'm having this thought about the teacher. And I can't help myself. I think the thought is in my head. I think it's just in my head. And all of a sudden, I'm standing up and I'm saying it. And it goes like this. I really think that you're not qualified to be teaching me. I believe you have this job because it is convenient and you can be home when your children get home from school. And I'm suspended. So I'm suspended, but Bob and Nell are dividends, which means that they work at the school, they volunteer. My dad is coordinating Key Club and my mother is I don't know what. I'm suspended and they are still going to do their volunteer work at the school, while their only child is suspended. So if you can see, my parents are showing up, and my drinking and my alcoholism, I did not show up. I had no ability to show up in my drinking. Showing up was not something that happened, although my parents continually showed up. So I get out of high school, and I get to go to school. And here's the alcoholic screwed up thinking. I want to go to a big city, but I don't want to go too far away, because I want to be able to get back home when I want to get back home. So I go to Atlanta, and I get a pretty nice scholarship to a school in Georgia where the ratio of boys to girls is 5 boys to 1 girl. So I'm ready. I'm going to Atlanta. It's all boys, and I'm set. So I'm in Atlanta, and it's a big city. And it's fun. And I'm not drinking so much because I'm really into school. My drinking is very controlled. I'm drinking on Wednesdays and Fridays. Okay? I can't drink on Saturday because I go to church on Sunday. I don't go to church because I want to go to church. I go because we go to church. I was raised that way. I wanted a relationship with God, but what I was doing was just keeping up the appearance to church, because what the neighbors thought was a very important piece of my childhood. So I wanted to be able to tell my parents that I was going to church, blah, blah, blah. But I'm drunk as a skunk on Wednesdays and Fridays, and it's very controlled. And one of the things I know about my drinking is that I couldn't control it and enjoy it. If I was controlling it, I wasn't enjoying it. And if I was enjoying it, I wasn't controlling it. Ever. Ever. So what happens in Atlanta is I'm acting out in all sorts of alcoholic ways, with or without alcohol, and I get the emergency Visa card from my father, and it turns into emergency shoes and dresses and unauthorized trips to various places. And I get recalled. The International Bank of Dad decides to move me from Atlanta to Gainesville, Florida, where there's no shopping. And I'm in Gainesville, and there's no shopping, but there's lots of drinking. And this is where my drinking starts to spiral into alcoholism, into alcoholic drinking. Because that's the time when I remember having that thought, I need a drink. I need a drink. Like, I need to be breathing. And I'm not kidding you when I tell you, that's how I needed a drink. And I could manage school to a point. I couldn't manage my drinking. And what started to happen was school started getting in the way of my drinking. You may be familiar with things getting in the way of your drinking. And it fell, you know, to the wayside. And eventually I was able to finish my degree. And what I wanted to do and what I've always wanted to do is to work at a university. That's always been my dream. And the only thing I ever really wanted to do. And I got, my parents had at this time moved down to South Florida to Boca Raton, to a lovely community where they were just fabulous. And they are just fabulous. I mean, they are. But then I moved down there, and the whole what will the neighbors think thing turns into like a whole, we take that up to a whole nother level. And I go to work on my degree at Florida Atlantic University, and I have this job at the university that I love, but I'm drinking, and it's out of control. I'm functioning, but I'm drinking every day. And I'm starting to get locked up. People are trying to fix me. Usually some man who mistakes me for some girl he wants to date and realizes what I really am, which is just a manipulative Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, psychopath, alcoholic, crazy person who needs to be in this relationship with this man for money and a place to live and drinks and whatever it is that I personally would need to survive. So this is how I'm functioning. And people start checking me in to the psych ward. Okay, so what I realize is that I'm being Baker-acted and Marchman-acted on a regular basis. One of the things that I did a lot of is I drank in my car. And I would drive to the beach in Fort Lauderdale, and I would pass out in my car with the windows rolled up in the summer, and somebody would call the cops, and they would come and get me out of my car and marchman act me into the hospital. So what I figured out was that I was there for 72 hours. So what I needed to do was maintain for 72 hours and then get out and start drinking again. So, you know, I could look at the paperwork and figure out when I got checked in, and then I was planning for the release, for the right, the 72 hours. I can do math. This is all right. But nothing is getting better. I mean, nothing is getting better. And I read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous because I've been sent to EAP, Employee Assistance Program, at the university because I'm drinking all the time. I'm drinking warm vodka in my car in the parking lot at lunch. There's a desk drawer that nobody can open because there's liquor in it in my office. And I'm the undergraduate advisor in the College of Business. This is not a good thing. And you know, people are still loving and supportive and trying to fix me, and I'm drunk. And I'm crazy. And I'm on the beach with a pitcher of margaritas reading the big book, highlighting 80% of what I'm reading because I relate. This is me. I'm not willing to stop, but yes, this is really helpful information. Thank you. And then Bob and Nell are at their wit's end because they're living in this lovely gated community. And I'm jumping the gate and sneaking in there in my car using the fire department code to get through the gate. And I'm working at the university, and I'm also working at a bar, and I'm stealing cases of vodka from this bar, and I'm hiding them behind the air conditioner at my parents' house. Which is great until the lawn guy and the air conditioner guy go knock on the door and say, "We don't know if you mean to have this half case of vodka out here by your air conditioner, but okay." So at this point, Bob and Nell find Al-Anon. And I will tell you, if it weren't for Bob and Nell finding Al-Anon, I would not be sober. Because they're very smart people, and they follow directions really well. And after a little while in Al-Anon, someone said, "What you need to do is cut her off." And they did. And they didn't just cut me off financially, emotionally. I went over to their house one day after I had passed out for the third time on the front lawn of their lovely gated community where all the women put lipstick on to go out and get the paper in the morning, and here's Susie passed out in the front yard. And there's a lovely police officer from Palm Beach County there with a little pink piece of paper that said, "I will escort you and your car out of the county because your parents have decided with the help of the courts that you are a danger to yourself and others, and you cannot be in Palm Beach County." And that was it. I had $20 and a lot of vodka and my dog in the car, and I came back to Orlando because I had nowhere else to go. And they were done. It was game over. There was no money, there was no phone calls, there was nothing. And these are people who went through all that trouble to adopt me. But something happened that I don't remember. And this is important to know because there are long periods of time in my life that I honestly don't remember. And one of them was this. I had passed out in my car at the beach and was taken to the hospital and was put in cardiac ICU because they couldn't stabilize my blood pressure and I had alcohol poisoning. And I was in there for several days, and they told my parents that they might need to start planning my funeral. And that's what my parents did. And they were done. They've been married for, let's see, 48 years. And the only time they ever talked about getting a divorce was because of my drinking. Because my father wanted to save me and my mother wanted to kill me. And without Al-Anon, they couldn't reach any compromise. And the compromise wound up being cutting me off. Which I do know from my own experience now in the program that we can love people to death. And sometimes we need to get very real and very harsh with people and tell them the reality of the situation is that people die. And that could have so easily been me. And I came back to Orlando, and I'm still drinking. I'm still drinking, and I'm still being checked in regularly. This is great. So I can't even count the number of times that this happens. But I need to get sober, and I know that AA is where I need to be. And I get this sponsor, and she was fabulous. She fired me because I couldn't stop drinking. But she was fabulous. And one of the things that she told me, well, she told me a couple things that I remember. One of them was she made me go to meetings where I was uncomfortable. I grew up out in Longwood, and what I did was I came back and I went up to those meetings, and it was like all the women that I knew that were like my friends' parents. So it was lovely. It was like, I don't know, going to brunch or something. But it wasn't the way I drank. Because in my drinking, my morals just sort of slipped away on the slippery slope. Because I started here being brought up to be this certain kind of girl, and I turned into the exact opposite of that particular girl in my drinking, because I needed to do what I needed to do to get what I wanted. And it didn't matter what that was, because I needed a drink. And whatever needed to be done to get that drink was just what needed to be done. We'll deal with that later. So this fabulous woman, Sharon, had me going to these meetings that scared me. But they were the people who drank the way I drank. Because I was going up to this lovely women's meeting and I was drunk. And I would pass out on this woman that I had known all my life, She was the mother of one of my friends. And I would sit next to her at this fabulous women's meeting, and I would pass out on her. So I started going to meetings with this sponsor who took me to meetings where people drank like I drank. And it was scary, because the way I drank was scary, and the way these people drank was scary, but I got it. When they were talking about it, I got it. And she told me this, too. She was asking me if I was willing to go to any lengths to get sober. And I sort of, meh, you know. And then she said, what I want you to do is have in your head a very specific example of the lengths that you went to get a drink. So I choose when I speak to share the more G-rated version. and what that version is this. I lived in Sanford on Airport Boulevard near 1792, and there was an ABC liquor store up 1792 that has since closed again because I've moved away. And I don't drink anymore. And there was an electrical storm that was the kind of electrical storm where they're on the television telling you not to get in your car, that kind of storm. But I need a drink. I have no shoes on in the electrical storm, and I have scrounged a plastic bag full of change to walk up to the ABC in the electrical storm with no shoes and my plastic baggie full of change to buy the cheapest bottle of vodka I can find so that I don't die. Because when I tell you I needed a drink, I was going to die without that drink. And I walked up there in the electrical storm with my bag of change and no shoes and back to the apartment to get a drink. So if I'm home and it's raining, and I don't want to go to a meeting, or I don't have a dollar to put in the basket, so I don't want to go to a meeting, I have this picture really fresh in my head so that I know I can still go to a meeting because of what I did. The lengths that I went to get a drink are the lengths that I have to go to be sober. So this fabulous sponsor fired me because I couldn't stop drinking, and I get it. So I need a sponsor. I'm desperate. I can't stay sober, and I need a sponsor. And I pray for a sponsor. And I go to a meeting that I didn't want to go to, and this fabulous woman comes in this red power suit, looking great. And then she shares something that I had done that I would never share ever, like on my list of things you'll never know about me. And she just shares it in that meeting like it's no big deal. And I leap over tables and chairs and I grab her and I say, oh my God, you have to be my sponsor. And she said yes, even though she looked a little frightened. And she's still my sponsor, which is wonderful. And she started working the steps with me. I had no ability to be honest. And I was still filled with fear. And she was a lovely woman with a nice place to live and a nice job. And I thought, if she knows the truth about what I have done, she will not sponsor me. So we did a four-step, and I didn't tell her everything, and I drank. And we did a four-step, and I didn't tell her everything, and I drank. And this is going on and on. This is a great pattern. And I finally tell her the things that I didn't want to tell her. And she didn't bat an eye. I mean, I think I could have told her that I was a mass murderer, and it would have been okay. And she would have said, well, put that down on your four-step, and we'll work on that. And that's what I needed. Because I had behaved in ways that were so unacceptable to me that for years I couldn't look at myself in the mirror. I couldn't put makeup on because that required looking in the mirror. And I couldn't look at myself and be okay. So I couldn't imagine that some fabulous woman who's sober lets me into her house and wants to work with me, given my moral decline, and that's the nice way of putting it, and my behavior. And she did want to work with me. And I thought for a long time that shut up and get in the car was the first step, because that's what she did to me. She would come and get me and take me all sorts of places, and I didn't want to talk to anyone but my sponsor. Because I was terrified of making friends. I didn't know how to have friends. I mean, I knew people where I drank, but they weren't my friends. if I don't go to my home group on a Saturday morning, I get 3 phone calls that afternoon asking me where I was. Nobody ever called from the bar to find out where I was. They might have called to find out why the money was missing, but they didn't call to find out if I was okay. And she had me build this village of women, which is the last thing I ever wanted to do. And I would follow her around like a puppy dog and only talk to her, and she would take me to these weekends and these conferences and these conventions, and she would foist me off on other people. And she would say, well, you need to go to lunch with these people. And I'd say, I don't know those people. I don't want to go to lunch with those people. I'd say, well, you need to know those people. And she was right. I need to know those people. Because when I relapsed, and I did it a lot, when I relapsed, it always started with the disconnect. It started with me saying, I can miss that meeting. I don't need to call my sponsor today. That's the beginning of the slippery slope for me, of just working my way towards another drink. Because every day I have things that I need to do to be sober, and I didn't know that. And I wasn't ready to do all those things because I thought if I stop drinking, everything's going to be great. Right? I'm not drinking, things should be fabulous. But I'm not drinking, and I'm still me. I'm just me without alcohol, which means I'm feeling my feelings. I have absolutely no coping skills, no coping skills, because drinking was my solution. Drinking was my coping skill. What happened at the end of my drinking, the last time I was in a psychiatric hospital, the doctor asked me if I was suicidal, and I said, no, I just don't care. I'm not actively trying to kill myself, but I'm not really that concerned about staying alive. And so you know they consider that suicidal. and they signed the paper to keep you longer. but that was where I was. It was this apathy of I don't care. Because when I was sober out in the world, I was terrified. And I was sad, and I was lonely, and I was full of regret and remorse and self-hatred. Self-hatred. Wow. It was awful. I didn't like me. Why would you like me? I don't want to be alone in a room with me. Oh, my gosh. Are you kidding? And I learned to like myself because you liked me. And even if you didn't like me, you pretended like you liked me, which was awesome. And you loved me, and you told me to come back. And telling me to come back was great because I was just kicked out of Palm Beach County, which is a big county, and they really didn't want me back there. And I needed to find my people. Now, I came back to Orlando, and I knew I had found my people when I went to an AA meeting and I walked in and the vice principal of my high school, who was the person that suspended me 4 times, was in the meeting. And I walked in and I said, Coach, what are you doing? And he said, I'm just waiting for you, Shukovsky. And I said, wow. I said, wow. And once upon a time, I had drank my way out of UCF, which my grand sponsor tells me is a very difficult thing to do, but I managed to do it. And I had to petition to be readmitted to the university. When I was at Florida Atlantic University, the then associate dean of my college asked me to usher at graduation, which was one of the things that I was very excited about because it was a real uppity academic thing to do, and I thought that would be fabulous. And what I did instead of usher at graduation is I drank and I passed out in the bathroom of the computer science building. Yeah, that was good form. And I did that. And so I petitioned at UCF to be readmitted. And they give you this really long petition. And it always says, like, attached additional paper if needed. And it said, there were 2 questions, and it said, describe the circumstances that led to your dismissal and academic blah blah blah. And all I knew was I was drunk. And I called my sponsor and I said, this is all the information I have, and she said, well, write it down. And then the next little line said, what has changed that will ensure us that you no longer blah, blah, blah? And I wrote, I'm sober. And I called my sponsor and I said, I don't know what else to say. And she said, well, that's all there is to say. And then I went before the board, which is like all the muckety-mucks at the university, like the people I want to be, the muckety-muck people. And I handed my petition, and they're all looking at it, and it has two lines on it. I was drunk. I'm sober. And the provost says, does anyone have any questions for Ms. Schakowsky? And I'm like, ready. You know, whatever the questions are, I'm all set. And nobody had any questions, and they stamped it and let me back into the university. That was honesty. And that was honesty without embellishment. That wasn't me thinking I needed to tell them all my tale of woe, because my tale of woe was self-inflicted. They don't care about that. They don't need to know. I mean, if they ever need to ask me about it, I'm happy to share, but they don't need to know. But the scary part for me became that the dean of my college is the man that was the associate dean at FAU who had asked me to usher, and I drank and passed out instead. And not only has this man allowed me back in his college, he has me on his staff. And I can't tell you how these things happen except through Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can be at school, and he'll walk by me, and he'll say, do you have anywhere you need to be? And that's secret code for, Susie, you really need to go to a meeting. And last week, I had a day where I was not at my best, and I was doing my best imitation of Meryl Streep in The Devil Wears Prada, where she goes, that's all. And I was that way with everyone that entire day. And I'm sober. And I still behave that way. Because when I'm irritated, which happens a lot, I think I'm irritated with you, but I'm not. I'm irritated with me, and it sucks. Because I call my sister, and she says, well, you might want to take a look at that in you. Because what I see in someone else that's making me uncomfortable is something in me that I need to be looking at. And I hate making amends. So I'm always trying to be on good behavior. But when I came in, I didn't know what good behavior was. And I had to learn. And I have to start with get up in the morning, say your prayer, and brush your teeth. I mean, I was there. I was starting there. Clean clothes, stuff like that. I mean, it was pretty basic when I got here. Because I had lost everything. When I was in South Florida really drinking hard, I had fallen in with people, oh my gosh, I can't even tell you. But I mean, things happened that were just wrong. I mean, there was a lot of death, and there was someone tried to set the house I was living in on fire. And I mean, it was just like one alcoholic disaster after another. And I was used to living in the chaos. And we get really comfortable with living in the chaos and the drama. And I see this in myself, and I see it with people, women I work with. It's hard to let that drama go and accept the peace, because you're used to the drama. And you're used to that you know, it's adrenaline, it's excitement. And when it's gone, and you're just, you know, having some happy, joyous, and free, fabulous day, going to a meeting, having coffee, I spend a lot of time wondering what was going to go wrong. Like, it's starting to feel really comfortable and like things are nice. Something horrible is about to happen. I just know it is, because it always has. But my behavior has changed so that it doesn't have to happen. That horrible whatever it is isn't back there. That's a figment of my imagination. But I can sabotage things and create those chaotic situations. And someone I love very much looked at me one day when I said, I think I've fallen back into an old behavior. And she looked at me and she said, Susie, if you're still doing it, it isn't old behavior. I just looked at her and I said, thanks for sharing. I gotta go. And, but she's right, you know? And this is an everyday project in my life. Because I was just talking to my sponsor today. The more I think I know in AA, the more I realize I have to learn. Because as soon as I start to get a little comfortable, I'm in trouble. Because then I'm resting on my laurels, and Laurel doesn't like to be rested upon, according to my sponsor. And then I'm complacent, and then I'm in trouble. And that's why I do a lot of service work, and I do a lot of work sponsoring people. And it's craziness. Because I know my sponsor, and I know my sponsor's sponsor, and I can follow this line of sponsorship, which is good for me because I like to have information. But I also have this group of women that's like the sponsees and the co-sponsor people of this little group that I'm of women, my little village, as my sponsor calls it. And I'm accountable to these women. And when I have a question or an idea or a thought, or I think I might be making this fabulous decision, I run it by these women. Because a lot of times the answer is, are you kidding? Yes, that sounds good, but let's work it out. And I never did that. I never in my drinking, ever, did I stop and pause and talk to other women who knew, who had walked this path before me, who had the experience. And I've had issues that my sponsor didn't personally have, and she would, like, outsource me to another woman in the program who had that experience so that I could have someone to talk to understand that. But I build this community, and I watch my sponsor build this community. And then you get sucked into these service things, and before you know it, you know all sorts of people. And if you drink, you're going to have to go tell all these people. And my ego is just not going to let that happen. And so in order to do that, I have to do the work. And what has happened is I've found a God of my understanding. When I was doing my first, second, and third step work with my sponsor, and she asked me to think about the God of my understanding, I got real churchy and academic and thought that, you know, I had this upbringing where God is in the white robe, blah, 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 long gray beard, whatever. And that wasn't working for me. And I came up with my own conception of God that I actually have like a mental picture of my God in my head. And I can imagine my God sitting next to me in the car, going places with me, and I can have a conversation with the God of my understanding because I have this picture. And I know it sounds so queer, but I needed God to be my friend. I needed God to be my friend because prayer is great and church is fine and all these things are fine, but one of the problems that I had that my sponsor pointed out to me is that I was constantly trying to put God in a box. I wanted God to be this neat, well-defined entity that I could, you know, say, well, here's God, ta-da, right here. And it wasn't working because my God needed to be big enough and flexible enough and versatile enough to deal with all sorts of things. I needed my God to be with me all the time. Something happens and there's the hamster on the wheel in my head, and there are the five other hamsters waiting in line in case that one hamster gets tired. They just do the rotation thing. I needed a God that I could take that to and say, there are six hamsters in my head and they're all on the wheel and I have no idea what I'm doing, and talk to God like that and learn to listen to God. But what happened for me is that I heard God in the rooms. I heard God from people in the rooms, which is showing up for meetings, which again was always the beginning of the disconnect that led to relapse for me, was not going to meetings because God speaks through you. And when I'm having a day where I'm looking at this big book and I'm thinking, this isn't working and I need some proof, you're my proof. You're sitting here on a Saturday night, sober, being my proof that this works. And when I hear you share your stories, you're my proof. And I can bring a newcomer to the meeting, and they can hear you go around the room and share your struggles and share your successes, and you're their proof. And that's why the going to meetings and the reaching out and talking to people is so important. I was listening to my sponsor talk to someone this morning who doesn't want to talk, doesn't want to share in meetings, and she's listening, but she's not sharing, so we're not hearing where she is. And she thinks that she can't share unless it's a good thing. But I'll come into a meeting and tell you that I'm just crazy. Something is really wrong with me today. And you need to know. Because if I don't tell you where I am in this dangerous neighborhood in my head, you don't know how to support me in sobriety. And I don't know how to support you in sobriety. Because we all do this together. And that was something that really turned me off about the steps, was that it was all about we. I'm like, we? The last few years of my drinking, honey, there was no we. It was just me. It was me locked in my little apartment with the blinds closed, hiding my bottles even though I lived alone with my dog. In case, you know, the dog was going to start drinking. But, I mean, hiding my bottles alone, there wasn't any we. I didn't know how to have a we. I didn't know how to have a relationship with another human being. Not necessarily a romantic relationship. I certainly didn't know how to do that. But I didn't even know how to have just a friendship. Because I was never a friend. I was always calculating what I could get from you. What do I have to do for you to get what I want from you? And that doesn't exist in my life anymore. What exists in my life now is, what do I have to do to stay sober today? And I have to be of service to stay sober. I have to keep my side of the street clean to stay sober. I have to work the steps. I have to do these certain things to stay sober. I don't know which one it is that keeps me sober, so I'm just going to continue to do all of them because it's been helpful to me. And I want to read this little paragraph out of the big book because it sort of sums up my personal AA experience. It's from the family afterward, and it says, "Everybody knows that those in bad health and those who seldom play do not laugh much. So let each family play together or separately as much as their circumstances warrant. We are sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. We cannot subscribe to the belief that this life is a veil of tears, though it once was just that for many of us. But it is clear that we made our own misery. God didn't do it. Avoid, then, the deliberate manufacture of misery. But if trouble comes, cheerfully capitalize it as an opportunity to demonstrate his omnipotence." And that's what this is all about. This is all about, I can be happy, joyous, and free even when things aren't the way I want them to be. I had to take a sponsee to jail this week to turn herself in, and it was really hard. I watch women struggle to get sober. I struggle myself to stay sober. But I show up and I do the deal. And my God is big enough to handle these things. And when I have that little feeling that my God isn't big enough, I have all the people in AA in Central Florida to call, to see, to reach out to tell you that something's wrong with me and my God apparently has taken the day off. And I can borrow your God, which sometimes I need to do. But that's what keeps me sober. Thanks for being here tonight. Mm-hmm.